And the time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, where this program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at realdirt.net. And this KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA, and online at kboo.fm. My name is Andrew Geller, and we are going to continue today with a series of programs that's going to stretch all through 2006 that I'm calling It Is Happening Here, based on a modification of a title of a book from Sinclair Lewis, written back in 1935, called It Can't Happen Here, about the fascist takeover of the government of the United States, a point which I will contend has happened, regardless of how people want to feel about it. I feel like that has already taken place. And not only the government, but the society of this country exhibits behavior consistent with seven other modern fascist states, as studied by Lawrence Britt, guest on the previous or inaugural show related to this series. Today we're going to look at the first characteristic he lists common to all modern fascist states, and that is the expression of powerful and continuing nationalism. And joining me this morning to talk about this, I'm very pleased to welcome back to KBOO and this program Michael Parenti. He is a prolific author and lecturer. He has a PhD in political science from Yale. He's taught at a number of colleges and universities, both in the U.S. and abroad. His most recent book is called The Culture Struggle, before that Super Patriotism, and many others dating back to the late 60s. Welcome back to our airwaves, Michael.
Hello, Andrew.
So, I am specifically interested in talking about nationalist expression, and I kind of want to draw a little bit of a distinction between nationalism and patriotism. If you don't want to, that's fine. There's kind of a blurring of the line that some people are fine with, and sometimes folks want to keep the two distinct. So we can choose our own style in the course of the next half hour.
Yeah, well, I think ruling interests use nationalist appeals to gain a free hand and to get people to surrender their rights to the leaders. It's an old ploy, and certainly fascism carries it to new heights or new depths, for everyone's sake. So it's sort of hand over your rights to me. These are not normal times. There are enemies at the gate, and so the nation must survive. If the nation doesn't survive, we all perish. This is the one supreme and common interest we have. So as Mussolini said, everything for the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. So fascism is a kind of exaggerated nationalism. That's the way Hans Kohn, the historian and student of nationalism, once put it. It refines it and carries it to almost a cult level of worshiping the nation state, giving your life to the state. But it's not a clear and precise line, because in many non-fascist countries, you always got this same kind of appeal, you know, no man has done a higher thing than lay down his life for his country. God, king and country. So the nation, instead of being an instrument of rule in which, a society, a nation-state society where people live and the laws are provided and there's a contract of, you know, I have certain rights and you respect these rights and I'll be a good citizen and so forth, the nation instead becomes a sort of an end in itself, almost a mystic cult, object of worship, and you sacrifice yourself to that nation.
Now, in the course of doing some background reading for this program, I found a very fascinating article that was in the May-June 2003 issue of Foreign Policy, and it's called The Paradoxes of American Nationalism, written by Min-Jin Pei, who is a senior associate and co-director of the China program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And what he contends is that, first and foremost, most Americans don't recognize American nationalism. It's really easy for Americans to say, for kind of a very contemporary example, Islamic nationalism, or which isn't exactly nationalism because it's religiously oriented, but the idea of an ideologically driven fervor. And he also states that American nationalism isn't defined by and large in the traditional context of ethnic superiority, because the United States is made up from so many different ethnicities and cultures and religions, and that it's really more this kind of American exceptionalism and the idea that, you know, we can't do wrong, and our ideals of democracy, human rights, and kind of other fundamental American political and societal concepts can and must be spread elsewhere.
Yeah, in my book, Super Patriotism, I have a whole chapter called The Messianic Nation. That the nation, in a sense, assumes kind of messianic reaches. And I've talked to middle American audiences, and I kind of enjoy seeing them startled when I say to them, a lot of nations have felt this about themselves, that we are exceptional. So, you know, the French, Michelet, talking about how great ideas don't exist until they have a platform in Paris, and France is the center of Western civilization. The German nationalists did this about Germany. The Russian nationalists talked about Holy Mother Russia. Dostoevsky talked about it. that would lead the world away from its depravity and its crass materialism, bring it to a new spiritual level. The Indian nationalists in India, the Indian National Congress in the 19th century, talked about the same thing, about an Aryan virtue and to reinvigorate the world and save the world. The Italian nationalist Mazzini preached this sort of thing, that Italy would emerge reunified and lead a family of nations to democracy and this and that and the other thing. So this idea that this country is so exceptional, this country is so marvelous, there's no country like it, and we can then preach to everyone else and show them the way and bomb them if they don't do it quite right, and then after we bomb them, then we'll hold elections there, you know. That's happened in Yugoslavia and Iraq now, and it looks like Iran is being slated the same way, Afghanistan and such. So, the idea that we Americans are unique and exceptional and have a special message for the world is a very unexceptional message. I mean, all sorts of people thought they were the cat's meow, they were God's gift to humanity. And so it's happening with America, too, that this nation is like nothing else in the world. And, of course, it does have a unique history, but every country has a unique and extraordinary history filled mm-hmm. with all sorts of triumphs and defeats and marvelous accomplishments and horrible atrocities and unusual ethnic mixes and leading personalities of one kind or another. You know, so this is what I try to say. We're not God's gift to humanity. We're about as virtuous and evil-ridden and self-deluding and hypocritical as every other nation. And because this country has so much power and so much reach, it has more license to commit these sins, more room to commit these kind of sins and to impose ourselves. And we really should say, what gives us the right to go here, to go there, to bomb a country, say Panama, bomb its working-class neighborhoods in El Chiria, kill thousands of people, then occupy it and say, hey, we're going to give you a better government now, and you bring in this corrupt government, which ends up with more unemployment, more poverty, and more U.S. investment, more inequality, or the same with Grenada or any number of other countries that the U.S. has done these things to.
Well, let me read a small piece here from the Messianic Nation chapter of Super Patriotism. You write, quote, "The messianic impulse is compounded when national virtue is wedded to extraordinary military power. The super patriots see evidence of their divine calling in the very power that enables them to thrust themselves into every corner of the world. The contention that we must mobilize our power in order to lead soon becomes we must lead because we are so powerful." Senator William Fulbright in 1966 said, quote, "We are not God's chosen savior of mankind, but only one of mankind's more successful and fortunate branches, endowed by our Creator with about the same capacity for good and evil, no more or less than the rest of humanity." Now,
Well, that's nice. Every author always likes to hear and read from his book. Thank
all right,
you.
Well, right. That'll be the end of that then.
No, don't let me stop.
Okay. Well, now something that's really come to the fore in the past 5 years or so, maybe a little less, not the entire Bush administration's tenure, but certainly in the immediate aftermath of the attacks of September 11, the concept of homeland, which might sound disturbingly familiar to some of the older residents of this country or younger people who have relatives that were in Europe during the 30s and 40s. And the only, the phrase homeland can be applied really to any nation, but it takes a certain kind of cultural dynamic to really bring that out to a mass audience and convince people that, you know, things need to now be viewed as homeland or or and everyone else. You know, it's a real us-them concept that the Bush administration has been promoting vis-a-vis the rest of the world, but specifically folks in folks acting through terrorism.
Yeah, 9/11 was a made-to-order godsend, which is what leads a lot of people to the suspicion that he was looking the other way and was quite happy to let it all happen. And in any case, it evoked and stoked a fear and a siege psychology. And right, the sacred homeland now, aliens, enemies at the gate or right within our midst. So we have to suspend critical judgment and rally around the leader who has himself wrapped in the flag and pursue any policy he wants. You know, the policies he's pursuing, and this is happening in a number of Western states, are very akin to what was pursued in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. When the Nazis came into power in Germany and the fascists in Italy, they cut the inheritance taxes for the super rich. They cut corporate taxes in half or in some cases down to nothing. They cut wages for ordinary people. They destroyed labor unions. They began to abolish human services and that sort of thing. They privatized any number of publicly owned industries, utilities, and such. And they began to deregulate industry, lifting regulations that protected the public or the environment. Now, does any of that sound familiar? Well, so what you have is a ruling corporate-dominated class doing these things today, but keeping the accoutrements or trappings of democracy as they do it. I mean, we still have elections, and they'd like to get rid of all that ultimately, but they're doing it quite well by rigging these elections with touchscreen machines and dominating the media and airwaves and suppressing the vote in working-class neighborhoods. And so they come around doing the same things. And you see that with the Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. You know, when Mussolini came to power in Italy, he smashed the opposition newspapers and just went in with his goon squads and smashed their presses and destroyed their offices and arrested their editors and whatever, and imposed the monopoly press. Well, Berlusconi today doesn't walk around in jackboots and, you know, in a helmet and looking like a Benito Mussolini. He wears a business suit and he has a nice warm smile and a quip on his lips and he waves to the crowd. But he doesn't destroy the media. He just owns them all. You know, he owns all the TV, all the private TV stations in Italy are owned. So they've learned to do and accomplish the same monopoly of near monopoly of political economic power while keeping appearances of democracy. And Bush's whole talk last night, what struck me was this vocabulary of totalitarianism in it that was slipped in, where he said, we've got to avoid partisanship and this partisan kind of squabbling and this sort of thing. Well, partisanship means opposition. He talked about obstructionists, that we don't need obstructionists, you know, who are doing these kind of things. So there's a kind of vocabulary. Isolationists, he said. We have to avoid isolationists. That means people who don't want to be bombing and killing people in Iraq are isolationists and unrealistic, and they're turning away from the world as if the only way we can relate to the world is through a pattern of conquest, occupation, and dominance and violence. So they pick up these words and use them very opportunistically to preempt. And I'm saying, well, opposition, obstructionist, partisanship, that I have another name for that. That's called democracy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what democracy is supposed to be all about, where you hold the power wielders accountable and you ask them to explain and you resist their policies and oppose their policies if you find these policies to be in violation of human values and such.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. That's Michael Parenti. We're speaking today about nationalism in the United States as a characteristic of broader fascist tendencies. You can find out more about Michael Parenti online at www.michaelparenti.org, and Parenti is parent with an I at the end. There's links to many writings, some audio, opportunities to pick up any of his books. And we've got about 8 or 9 minutes left here, and want to come back to a slightly different tack on nationalist expression here, and that's the one that the people of the U.S., more than the government, have really picked up and run with, certainly encouraged by the government, but also encouraged by just the private economic system, and this is sort of the selling of patriotism. You know, flags, anything flag was heavily promoted for purchase following September 11, around the time of the invasion of Iraq. And there's a really fascinating article at Salon.com written September of 2002 called The Selling of 9/11. We're buying schlock because we want to remember, but the more we stock up on canned memorabilia, the faster we forget. There's also this bizarre instance where the Pentagon began engraving troops' gravestones with war marketing slogans, as well as the names of individual operations that troops were on. That has been done to a very, very limited... It's not actually really been done. Sometimes what had been done previously, World War II or Korea, was the theater of operation might be listed. Killed in France, killed in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
This was totally different, and previously it was always checked with the family. You know, the Pentagon would say, is it okay if we put this on there? And in some cases, with these war marketing slogans, that was done. But in some cases, they were just etched into the gravestone. And then there's been these weird sort of pseudo-commemorative events sponsored by the Defense Department around not only the 4th of July, but the anniversary of September 11, which the Bush administration legally got declared Patriot Day. August 2005, press release, Rumsfeld announces America Supports You Freedom Walk. And the Freedom Walk was to show support for the U.S. troops who are helping make this country free.
Yeah, what seems to come through in all these examples you give, Andrew, is that the equating of militarism with patriotism. That the more militaristic you are, the more patriotic you must be. Well, the other side of that coin is if you oppose militarism, then you must be lacking in patriotism, and you don't really love your country, and you don't really... and, hey, whose side are you on, anyway? You know, Bush never said, if either you're with us or you're against us. It was worse than that. He said, either you're with us or you're with the terrorists.
That's true. That in fact, is what the quote is.
The quote is that, yeah, either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. And us, then, it does get reduced to the nation state, not the government, not public policies, not questions about human service and all that, but the nation state and the military, its military arm. The expression of that arm is the military, and that's what it's about. And what we have today, the consequence is we have about $690 billion of our budget, really, if you count the stuff that's in the Department of Energy and the chunk of the national debt that we're spending on past wars and veteran expenses and such. it differs. People estimate it differently, but anywhere from half to almost two-thirds of the discretionary budget is spent on past, present, and future wars, and those wars are celebrated as and that military is celebrated as the embodiment of patriotism. You go to sporting events on special occasions. You see the military come out at halftime, marching around with its flags and all that. And people just applaud and stand up. They feel that this is keeping them safe in a terrible and threatening world, and so they buy into it. A lot of them do.
Yeah, I actually did. It's the first large scale sporting event I'd been to in at least 10 years, and I took my nephew to a I don't know if it was like semi-professional basketball game around town here, and did not stand for the national anthem. And the reaction I got, my nephew was okay with it. He stood, but I think it was more reflexive. And just the glares, just, you know, like, how dare you? Kind of a feeling, and not, you know, certainly wasn't feeling threatened, but really, really definitely stood out.
Yes, yes. They turned that into a cult expression of super patriotism. Everybody must stand now and sing the song about bombs bursting in air, rockets' red glare, and such.
I think that in just the last couple minutes here, I think something that is important to touch on is that the current, and I could just be wrong. I mean, you're the longtime history student and researcher, so tell me if I'm wrong here. But it seems like the wave of nationalism post 9/11 has ensnared a much broader segment of the overall population than previous. There's a book out called Who We Are, written by Robert Wiebe, or Wiebe, W-I-E-B-E. It's a new study of the phenomena of nationalism. It's reviewed in Washington Monthly, December 01. And he writes I've lost the actual direct quote here. But he references in this book that, in fact, left-leaning progressive folks are now also, you know, having flags out on their front porches and talking in a more patriotic flair. And public opinion polls bear that out somewhat in the past 4 years. Would you say that might be a fair statement, that it's gathered more of the left now than in previous instances?
I haven't observed that. I do know many on the left have to genuflect to 9/11, now had to for a long time, and had to preface anything they said with, this was a horrible, terrible event, and we have no sympathy for it, and we must bring the terrorists to justice, mm-hmm. Before they can get on to talk about what they want to talk about. So there certainly is that. We could point out there's a brighter side. I mean, Bush's opinion polls, approval ratings have dropped dramatically from 70-80% down to 30-40%. People are questioning the war, and there are people, including some real establishment figures, former generals and policymakers and whatever, who say that the whole thing, you know, was based on a charade and a bunch of lies. There are people who are saying the deficit spending and the national debt and the military budgets are all getting out of control, and so they're not buying into it as mindlessly as before.
And we're going to actually just have to leave it there, because I am out of time.
Okay. Well, at least we ended on a bit of an optimistic note.
Yeah, it's always nice to do. So people have been listening there to Michael Parenti, author and lecturer, speaking about powerful and continuing expressions of nationalism here in the United States. Again, you can find out more about his work at www.michaelparenti.org, P-A-R-E-N-T-I. Thank you very much for joining us again on the program, Michael.
Thank you, Andrew. Bye-bye.
Bye. And Thus concludes the second installment of It Is Happening Here, a look at fascism in the government and society of the United States, looking at powerful and continuing expressions of nationalism. The next segment of this series will feature disdain for the importance of human rights. And chances are good that will happen still in February. If you have questions or comments, you can send me email, kboo@riseup.net. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm will have links shortly to more reading material regarding today's show and the broader series. And I have a brief announcement here to play for you. And then coming up next, you will be hearing Making Contact.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 16th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 3rd through March 4th. This year's festival highlights include films from Angola opening and closing the festival, and an examination of the African legacy in Mexico through screening, symposium, and community conversation. Additionally, there will be a spotlight on AIDS in Africa, Women Filmmakers Week, and appearances by some of the directors at the film festival. For more information, visit AfricanFilmFestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.
Jump if you get Belletto Town. Drink if you get Belletto Taker. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi.